Okay. So, last year, I went on an Anapanasati retreat. It was led by Prakasha, and I'm very, very grateful for that retreat. Anapanasati. So, Anapana means in and out breath, and sati means mindfulness. But what really attracted me to the retreat was that I'd heard things about it, that it was about the mindfulness of breathing leading to sort of an insight practice. So sometimes those practices are called vipassana. But when we learn the mindfulness of breathing, we learn it initially as a samatha practice. So that's a practice that calms, that stills, that concentrates and integrates the mind. But anapana, sati, was about leading towards insight into the nature of reality. And it's a 16-line teaching, and on line 13, it's sort of one of the key lines in it. It says, contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe in, thus I train myself. Contemplating impermanence, I breathe out, thus I train myself. So I found it interesting that the first meditation instruction that Sangharakshita, that Banti had, which was in 1945, it was from a Theravadan monk called Bhikkhu Sona. And basically Banti had a book, a little booklet about Anapanasati. And he asked Bhikkhu Sona to explain it to him. So that was his first instruction. And one of the things that Bhikkhu Sona said was that it was the practice that the Buddha did on the eve of his enlightenment. So for some people, this practice, you know, is a practice that can, they're inspired that it can lead all the way to enlightenment. And in Banti's memoirs, he says that he's very grateful for being introduced to the practice, because for some time it was the anchor of his spiritual life in 1945 and some years after. So when I came back from this retreat, I got a bit of a surprise because I looked up the Anapanasati teaching in the Majjhima Nikaya and discovered that it was actually an 8-page sutra, and that the Anapanasati teaching was just 16 lines of that 8-page sutra. So I wondered, well, what else is in this sutra? And really this talk is about the first 2 or 3 pages of the sutta. So it's like the context of the Anapanasati teaching. So I want us to just take ourselves back 2,500 years ago to ancient India, to the place where the Buddha gave this teaching. Thus have I heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying in Sarvati, in the Eastern Monastery, the palace of Megara's mother. So the historical Buddha gave this teaching in a place where many disciples could gather and hear it. It was a monastery. It was actually a palace donated to the Buddha and his Sangha by his chief patroness. Now I was thinking, why can't she have her own name? Why does she have to be called Megara's mother? So I thought, well, the best thing to do when you read a sutra, sometimes it leads you to look up some other information. So I thought, I'll find out about Megara's mother. So I'm going to tell you her story, and it is relevant to this talk, but I'm just going to start with a little story. So her name actually was Visakha. And she came from a family who were followers of the Buddha. And one day the Buddha came to her town and gave a teaching. And she was only 7 at this time. And her and her whole family and all the servants from her family became stream entrants. So at the age of 7, she was a stream entrant. At 16, she was betrothed to be married into a very, very wealthy family. Her family had accumulated much merit. And this family lived in Sarvati, the place where the Anapanasati Sutta is given. And so she was very rich herself. She was marrying into a wealthy family, and she was a very accomplished woman. She was a stream entrant, and she was very, very loved by everybody that she met. But her father-in-law, who was called Megara, he was a staunch follower of the naked ascetics. And he would invite them to the house for food. And Visakha found it quite difficult that he would never invite the Buddha and his followers. So one day, a Buddhist monk, on his alms round, came to Megara's house. And Megara pretended not to see him. And he just carried on eating his meal. And Visakha was upset by this. And I think she used skillful means. She basically said to the monk, "Pass on, monk, pass on. My father-in-law is eating stale food." Now this really infuriated Megara, because there he was like a millionaire. And he didn't want his reputation tampered with. And so he threatened to throw Visakha out of the house. But because she was so well loved, basically all the servants and her father-in-law's advisors advised Megara that she was blameless and that she hadn't really done anything terribly wrong. However, Visakha said, "Well, I'm going back to my family." So Megara asked for forgiveness, but basically Visakha would only consent to stay in the house if Megara invited the Buddha and his followers for a meal. So Megara reluctantly consented, but he said he wouldn't be present. So that day came, and after the meal, the Buddha gave a sermon, and Megara, the father-in-law, hid behind a curtain to listen to it. And basically, he was incredibly moved. He heard the Dharma. He actually became a stream entrant on the spot, behind the curtain. He was very, very grateful to Visakha. And he said that, "I will respect you from now on as if you were my mother. In fact, I will call you Megara Mata, Megara's mother," because he felt so grateful. And his whole family... Megara, the whole family and all the servants in that family, they all became followers of the Buddha after that day. And basically, Megara's mother, Visakha, she had many children of her own, but she always made sure that the monks and nuns, you know, in the local area had their needs met, so that they had food, medicine and shelter. And one of the things that she gave was a palace with beautiful gardens, and that is the place where the sutta, where the teaching, the Anapanasati teaching, is set. So my point really of telling you that whole story is that the teaching takes place in a place of dana, in a place of generosity. It is one of the conditions for the arising of insight. Our second precept, with open-handed generosity, I purify my body. Dana is also the first perfection of the Bodhisattva. So we have Visakha, she's a woman of generosity. And she would basically give wherever was needed. And the same applies to us here, this building. You know, we wouldn't be here without it. And it is here because of a whole history of generosity and human effort to both build this Buddhist centre and maintain it, and all the dana that is put into this centre, and why we're here, why we're able to be here. So the Buddha gave this teaching in a large monastery. Basically, there was a large company of monks, and there were all the well-known elders, disciples of the Buddha, were present. And so there was Sariputra, there was Moggallana, there was Kashyapa, and Ananda. And for those of you who've seen the mural downstairs, in the shrine room downstairs, the triptych, those four monks, well, they're arahats, are present, plus Dharmadina. So they're all enlightened followers of the Buddha, disciples of the Buddha, and they are the arahats. So they are present. Now, on that occasion, the elder bhikkhus had been teaching and instructing new bhikkhus. Some elder bhikkhus had been teaching and instructing 10 new bhikkhus. Some were teaching and instructing 20, 30, 40 new bhikkhus. The new bhikkhus, taught and instructed by the elder bhikkhus, had achieved successive stages of high distinction. So the Anapanasati teaching takes place in an atmosphere of generosity. So the elders are teaching, they're sharing, they're communicating the Dharma to the new bhikkhus, and progress is being made. And it's said that the greatest gift is giving of the Dharma. So we've got a place of generosity, and there's a flow of generosity happening. It's like one can directly teach the Dharma, but also the Dharma just is given in action through helpfulness, friendliness, and kindness. So with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body, is the first precept. So another reason why they're gathering in a monastery. Now on that occasion, the full moon night of the Pavarana ceremony, which marks the end of the 3 months' retreat, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the community of bhikkhus. Then, surveying the silent community of bhikkhus, he addressed them thus: "Bhikkhus, I am content with this progress. I am content at heart with this progress. So arouse even more energy to attain the as yet unattained, to reach the as yet unreached, to realize the as yet unrealized. I shall wait here at Sarvati for another month, through the white water lily month, for the Kamundi full moon of the fourth month of the rains." So in India, the rainy season, or the monsoon, starts at the beginning of June, and it lasts about 3 months. So this is when the Sangha, or the spiritual community, have their rainy season retreat. They come together. But we celebrate our rainy season, as it were, our coming together of the Sangha, on the full moon in November, as Pranyadevi was saying. So it was last Sunday, Sangha Day. So this is partly why I'm giving this talk at this time. So for us, this is the beginning of the darkness and cold of winter. It's the time of year that we most confront death because the days are shortening and the trees are becoming bare. And in Subhuti's rambles last year, he said that the coming together of the Sangha was like transcending the cycle of the seasons, because the Sangha gives hope. So basically, it's as if it gives new life at a time when it's all going dark and there's a sense of decay. So as long as we've got shelter and we've got warmth in the winter for us, we don't depend on the weather in order to practice the Buddha's teaching. But what we can do is we can improve our conditions. So when it gets dark and depressing, we can make more effort to gather as a Sangha. So that's basically what Subhuti was saying, and I found that really interesting. And we've just had a wonderful Sangha Day festival. So when it rains, the bhikkhus can come together and they take shelter in the monastery. And the Buddha is aware that the conditions are ripe for greater attainment. So he's really content with the progress that's being made by the community of bhikkhus. And he makes a decision at the end of the third month, really at the end of the rainy season, that they're going to stay on for another month. So it's the full moon night, and they're actually seated in the open air, which suggests that even though it's not raining, but they're going to he's decided they're going to carry on their retreat because the conditions are ripe for more attainment. So he makes that decision to remain together collectively to deepen their practice on the basis of what's gone before. So he's putting good conditions for practice first before just doing what they normally do, which is a 3-month retreat. So then the Pavarana ceremony usually concludes this 3-month retreat. And it's a ceremony where they basically share and confess all their transgressions of the precepts, anything that holds them back in the Dharma life during those previous 3 months. So basically, when you realize you've done something unskillful, you can acknowledge its harmful effects on yourself and others, and you can share it, express regret, and undertake not to do it again. So that's the practice that we do, and they had their Pavarana ceremony to do that. So it's interesting that following the Pavarana ceremony, of sharing all this unskillfulness, it's the month when the white water lily blooms. And that month, it's named after the white water lily. And the white water lily is a symbol of purity. So with stillness, simplicity and contentment, I purify my body. So through the practice of stillness, simplicity and contentment, we can see our unskillfulness arising from our coveting of things, of people, of the way we want things to be. And we can make amends if we've been unskillful. So in that way, we purify ourselves in preparation for our practice going deeper. So the sutta continues. The bhikkhus in the countryside heard the Blessed One will remain right there at Sarvati through the white water lily month, the 4th month of the rains. So they left for Sarvati to see the Blessed One. Then the elder bhikkhus taught and instructed the new bhikkhus even more intensely. Some elder bhikkhus taught and instructed 10 new bhikkhus, some 20, 30, 40 new bhikkhus. The new monks, being taught and instructed by the elder monks, had achieved successive stages of high distinction. So basically, word had got out that the Buddha's staying longer. There's an atmosphere of spiritual progress, and it's attracting more bhikkhus. It's attractive. So it's after 4 months of intense collective practice that the Buddha gives the Anapanasati teaching. But first of all, he's got something more to say. Oh, I wanted to also say, yes, we might be wondering, well, where are the monks? Where are the nuns? All the monks are being attracted, but where are the nuns? I don't know. So, now on that occasion, the full moon night of the white water lily month, the fourth month of the rains, the Blessed One was seated in the open air, surrounded by the community of bhikkhus. Surveying the silent community, he addressed them. Bhikkhus, this assembly is free from idle chatter, devoid of idle chatter, and is established on pure heartwood. Such is this community of monks. Such is this assembly. So the first thing to say about this is that the Buddha is talking about the speech precepts. A condition for the arising of insight is purifying our speech. The community that he's going to teach the Anapanasati Sutta to is free from unskillful speech. Now, you may have heard of the five precepts, of which one of the precepts is that you undertake to abstain from untruthful speech. But there's also a list of 10 precepts, of which 4 of them are speech precepts. And they include abstention from harsh speech, useless speech, slanderous speech, and untruthful speech. So this company of monks are free from useless speech, from idle chatter. So all of their speech is helpful, it's got meaning, it helps connection with others, it's about friendship, it's about understanding the Dharma. It's never going to be gossip or frivolous. So it's a form of truthful communication. With truthful communication, I purify my speech, the fourth precept. So this community of monks, whose speech is pure, the Buddha says, are established on heart wood. So I wondered, well, what does this mean? So heartwood is the dense inner part of a tree, of the trunk of a tree, and it produces the hardest timber. So this is the heartwood. But interestingly, sometimes you come across the exact opposite in the Dharma. You have the Dharma described, the Dharma or the nature of reality, or shunyata, or emptiness, as the opposite. So in Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara, he describes how the self cannot exist. So he says, just as the trunk of a banana tree is nothing when split into pieces, in the same way too, the I is not a real entity when hunted out analytically. So what we think of as the trunk of a banana tree is in fact just a collection of leaf sheaths, and they're wrapped around each other. And if you hunt for the heartwood of the trunk by breaking taking the leaves apart, you just get to empty space. There is no heartwood. So sometimes it's opposite. There's a different use of the tree trunk in describing the Dharma. But here, in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha says that the community of monks is established on heartwood. So it's very firm, it's solid, it's imperturbable. So there's a clue to what this heartwood is in the next part of the sutta. The sort of assembly that is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect, an incomparable field of merit in the world. Such is this community of bhikkhus. Such is this assembly. The sort of assembly to which a small gift, when given, becomes great, and a great gift greater. The sort of assembly that is rare to see in the world. The sort of assembly that it would be worth travelling for leagues, taking long provisions in order to see. Now, I don't know if you recognise some of that, because it's actually in the Tiratnavandana, the salutation to the three jewels, the verse on the Sangha. And in that verse, it basically says that there are eight types of people who are worthy of offerings and worthy of hospitality, who are an incomparable source of goodness in the world. And these eight people are, I'll just roughly say who they are, they are the stream entrants, like Visakha, like Megara's mother. And those who are experiencing the fruits of stream entry. Then there's the once returners, and those who are experiencing the fruits of being once returners. So they've just got one more lifetime before enlightenment. And then there are the non-returners, and those experiencing the fruits of being non-returners, and they will get enlightened that lifetime. And then there are the arahats, and those experiencing the fruits of being arahats. They've attained enlightenment, and they are like the elders who I described earlier, who are teaching the new bhikkhus. So the heartwood of the spiritual community, they're either enlightened, or their journey towards enlightenment is assured, their stream entrance. They've entered the stream to enlightenment. That's the heartwood. So in our hearts, we see that a condition for our spiritual progress is that there are those who are further along the way than ourselves, and that we actually need them. So we recognise what we call spiritual hierarchy. That we wouldn't be where we are now without the noble Sangha, without those eight types of people. We wouldn't be here because the Dharma has been passed through the ages, you could say, by those eight types of people. So what we also discover in the sutta a little later is that the not only is there the heartwood, the noble Sangha, but there's a whole other collection of bhikkhus. And you might recognise yourself in this list. Okay, you might be one of the eight persons. fine. But you might also recognise yourself in this list. So I'll just say who else was present. So there were bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. There were bhikkhus who abide devoted to the four right efforts. Those who abide devoted to the five spiritual faculties. Those who abide devoted to the seven factors of enlightenment. Those who abide devoted to the development of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And finally, there were those who abide devoted to the mindfulness of breathing. So maybe you're there. So we are receptive to the mindfulness of breathing. We do it regularly at the centre. But it's also an insight practice. And our development of insight is conditional, like everything else. So it's dependent on our ethical practice of the five precepts, dependent on our practice of loving kindness, generosity, stillness, simplicity, and contentment, truthful communication, and mindfulness. Also, we're not separate from the Buddha who gave the teaching, and we're not separate from the Sangha, who we practice with and who we learn from. So insight is not about grasping a teaching and going off on your own to practice it for the rest of your life. Insight into the nature of reality is seeing its conditioned nature. Our ability to absorb and integrate insights into the Dharma are conditioned by our ethical practice and our connection to the Buddha and the Sangha. So realizing the conditioned nature of one's progress in the Dharma life and being receptive to those conditions makes one happy. So I'll just say that again. Realizing the conditioned nature of one's progress in the Dharma life and being receptive to those conditions makes one happy. In line 10 of the Anapanasati Sutta, it says, "Gladdening the mind, I shall breathe in. Thus I train myself. Gladdening the mind, I shall breathe out. Thus I train myself." So there's one sentence that I just want to expand on a bit. Through my talk, you might have built up an image of the Bhikkhu Sangha in the presence of the Buddha, all practicing in this monastery, which was donated by Migara's mother. So the sort of atmosphere of practice and attainment, it is bigger than the sum total of the individual parts. And the line that brings this out is, "It is an assembly to which a small gift, when given, becomes greater, and a greater gift becomes even greater." So a small gift becomes great, and a great gift becomes greater. So to me, in a Pali canon sort of way, it's a sense of magic. Because something is arising that's greater than the sum of the individual parts. And a term which emerged on the International Order Convention in India this year, and it was elucidated by Subhuti, was the term Sanghakaya. So you may or may not have come across this. Sanghakaya. So Sanghakaya comes into being when the coming together of the Sangha lifts any individual above themselves, beyond their individual self-clinging. So this inspired Sangha, that is greater than the sum of the parts, is a transcendental object. So this atmosphere, where the gifts are being given, there's teaching being given, there's learning, realization, confession, more bhikkhus being drawn in, the Buddha deciding to continue the retreat for longer because there's progress made, it's lifting the Sangha up and out of its mundane self. So we can have like the Buddha as a transcendental object. So the Buddha can inspire us and lift us up and out of our small aims, you might say. But so can the Sangha. The Sangha, when it when it is like Sanghakaya. So this, I think what's being described in the beginning of this sutta is an example of Sanghakaya. Something a bit magical is happening, and it's just sort of growing and flourishing, and progress is being made, and effort is being put in. So our meditative engagement with the 16 lines of the actual Anapanasati teaching is a bit like the transcendental subject. That's what's going on inside. So it's the inner process, something greater than your individual self, working through you as you practice and are receptive to the teachings. It's as if a pattern is unfolding within you that is bigger than you. So that's the transcendental subject. And then you've got the transcendental object, the Buddha and the Sangha, Kaya. So the transcendental object is drawing you beyond yourself, and the transcendental subject is something that's unfolding within you that's greater than you, than yourself. And they're both really important for the Dharma life. So going within and practicing the 16 lines of the Anapanasati Sutta is just one side of the coin of liberation from self-clinging. We all need the Buddha and the Sangha as transcendental object. And we'll need to engage with the Sangha and be of service to building the conditions for others to practice the Dharma. As these elder bhikkhus are doing, they are teaching and instructing. So we need a context to practice unselfishness in a way. So we need a transcendental object like the Sanghakaya to live out our inner realization, what's going on inside. So we need both. So I want to just finish with an example from my own, what I think is an example of this from my own life. So recently I went on a retreat. My big retreat this year. It was at a place that I'd never been before. And I'd heard lots about it, lots of stories, and I wanted to go there. It was the Women's Ordination Retreat Centre in Spain, called Akashavana. And I was on a retreat for order members. And this retreat centre is in a remote place in the mountains. So however much I had heard about Akashavana, it couldn't have prepared me for the actual experience of being there. Soon after I got there, I was just totally overcome with gratitude. I just completely fell in love with the place. Both the natural environment, but also the retreat centre itself. And what I really fell in love with was every time I saw how somebody had really taken care over something in creating this retreat centre. Just small things like... in fact, I'm not supposed to say much about this retreat centre, so I better not say. It's a magic place. But I found it really, really moved me. Just all these little acts of care that I could see around. And Yeah, I spent several days at the beginning of the retreat in a very open-hearted sort of metaphor state. And it might have, the fact that the sky was blue and the sun was shining, that might have contributed to that. But I think generally speaking, it was just that I was filled with gratitude and amazement, really, by this retreat centre. I just thought it was really incredible. And I likened it to Hercules pushing a boulder up a hill, because it is high up in the mountains, like higher than Snowdon, or it just felt as if a transhuman force had done it. I couldn't quite believe how it existed. It was a bit like magic being up there. So this retreat I was on, we were developing insight into the nature of reality, a kind of another angle on it. And whatever insights that I might have had on that retreat, they would have been conditioned by my 23 years of practice. But a very, very strong condition was the retreat itself and the retreat centre. So it was the company of the order members that I was with, practicing with. It was the leaders of the retreat. It was the organiser. It was the cook, of course. And it was the retreat centre itself. All those who'd had the vision to just find such a place, all those women who had fundraised, everybody who'd given money, those women who oversaw the building project, those women who live there and maintain the place and develop the centre, and all the different women who've been part of teams supporting retreats, and many, many different ways, countless ways, that people have helped to create this place. So it's basically, it is bigger than the sum total of its parts. It is definitely like a small gift becomes great, and a great gift becomes greater. It's got an energy of its own. So you can't separate the inner realization of a retreat from the conditions, and in this case, of being in a remote and beautiful retreat center. And with the Anapanasati teaching, you can't separate any realization that may arise from the practice from the context in which it was given. And it was given in the context of a vibrant Sangha practicing in the presence of the Buddha. So I'm just going to finish with a few lines. Gladdening the mind, I breathe in. Contemplating impermanence, I breathe out. Contemplating impermanence, I breathe in. Gladdening the mind, I breathe out.